Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to episode 8 of the Growing Forward podcast. I'm your hostess, Bethany Latham. And today I am speaking with Mr. Aaron David, who is a financial advisor. He also invests in real estate. And I think we get into a lot of really interesting things in this episode. I hope you all really enjoy it. Just a note, the sound was a little bit funky. I think Aaron was on a job site when we recorded this, but I think that the information is good enough to share anyway, so please excuse just what might sound like a little bit of background noise at certain times.
Okay, so hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Could you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about your background and interests? I know you're based in Seattle, Washington right now.
Yeah, I live in Seattle. I first moved here in 2016. A guy who I had worked with in construction became a superintendent, and he was up here in Seattle where he grew up. But we were talking on the phone, and he said he had a job coming up and could use some help and asked if I wanted to move up and work on his job that he had going. But also, really, the main reason why I came is because I had a lot of music friends here. I've been studying a type of West African percussion music for about 15 or 16 years now. At one point in 2013, a group of people invited me here to teach some of the things that I'd learned about that drumming. And so I was here for about a week and a half, and I met a lot of people interested in the same music.
Nice. And Seattle is just gorgeous. I love that whole area. I have family up there.
Yeah, a lot of green. Mm-hmm. A lot of green and gray.
Yeah, a lot of water too, just a treat.
Yeah, definitely.
So you mentioned when we spoke on the phone about doing this interview that, you know, you work in construction, but your primary business is real estate investing. And then you started on the side, Fist Pump Finance, which is what you know, we're primarily going to talk about today. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in business?
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't consider myself to be very, very adept at business. I feel like I'm just starting out. For a lot of the time that I was investing in real estate, I didn't really consider it to be a business. In the way that I think of business is usually finding a way to serve people and charge for it. And so I never really thought of the real estate as a business. And after I had already been investing, I started to realize, I'm developing systems here. I'm developing a network of people who I work with. I'm also, you know, providing jobs for people who do remodels and getting the places ready for rent. I'm hiring property managers. I'm kind of like, there's a lot of people involved in real estate. And just by me investing in real estate, it's like, I don't know, there's loan officers. There's all these people I'm working with who basically have a job because I'm investing in real estate. So it's almost, they're not my employees, but it's like more business than I originally thought. Mm-hmm. And as I started learning more about what business really is, I thought, oh, it's actually kind of a business. I have systems. I have a network of people I'm working with. You know, people have jobs because of what I'm doing. But with the real estate, I really got into it just because I wanted to be financially free. I sat down at one point in my life and wrote down like my ideal life. And a lot of the stuff that I wanted in my life would require me to make money without being at a job, basically, like passive income, basically, is what I saw I would need to be able to have those things that I was thinking about and writing out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I started investing in real estate just because I had a friend who became a real estate agent, and he was talking to me about what's possible. And then I just did a deep dive and pretty quickly was able to buy a property and kind of started down that path. With my financial business, really at the beginning stages, I've mostly been an employee most of my life, just working construction for on and off for 20 years now. So I'm very, very new to business. The financial business is more just because I'm experienced with investing with real estate investing. I've had some experiences in the stock market, and I just study finance so much. In fact, in the recent years working construction, there have been certain jobs I've been taking where I'm able to listen to a lot of podcasts or listen to audiobooks while I work. So the construction job has almost allowed me to get, like, I don't know, maybe 20 hours a week of studying in while I'm doing that job. I basically just I wanted to shift away from dependence on a job. And so at a certain point, my real estate was kind of like a bridge where I didn't need to work to pay my bills anymore. And so now I can start to get into business where I can feel like I can help people make some money doing it and continue studying the things that I love studying. And basically just, it's allowing me to spend my day doing exactly what I'd like to do, which is just talking about finance, talking about early retirement, helping people do what they want to do.
Right. Basically, you know, like helping people make intelligent financial decisions. So many people don't have the time or the interest to look into these things as much on their own, which is why do a financial episode on the show, because it's so important for everybody in this, you know, money-driven world that we live in to just have a basic understanding of how to intelligently manage their personal finances.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the name of your business, Fist Pump Finance. Can you explain why you chose that name?
it's basically just because I'm a nerd, and I really get excited about finance. I get excited when I learn something new. I get excited when I can tell someone something that they hadn't thought about before that's going to make their life better. It just feels great. I constantly find myself fist pumping, and ideally, like, the ideal result of my business is to get other people fist pumping about their own financial life and feel like they're winning where maybe they didn't before. So
sure. It's like triumph of your finances. That's how we should all feel.
Definitely.
Right?
Yeah. It's a nice feeling to have, like, you're winning, like you're leveling up. Yeah. I think everyone can relate with fist pumping. You know, people do it about different things. I personally do it about finance and financial freedom. And hopefully I can just share that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was looking at your website, and you tell a part of your story on the website where you were heavily investing in the stock market, and then you lost a lot of that in the 2008 financial crash. And now you don't advocate for total stock market investing because, as you say, you become powerless to the shifts of the stock market. So what alternatives do you recommend for people who do want to invest their money and have it work for them?
Well, yeah, I guess I should start by saying I think people should kind of partition their money a little bit. There's kind of a difference between savings and investing and speculating. And I think that a lot of people get it all mixed together. That's one of the things about the stock market, is it's kind of like all three of those things in one. It's an easy, convenient place for people to put their savings. And for people to think that they're investing there. From my experience, you know, I feel like that's a better place to put speculation money. So it's money that you don't mind losing a big chunk of. You're not going to need it at any particular time for supporting your lifestyle or anything. There are a lot of problems with the stock market when what you're going after is certainty and security. And when you have a timeline, when you want to retire at a particular time, it can also be problematic due to sequence of returns risk and other, you know, just volatility. So I think that if people understand that they're speculating, and whatever money they have earmarked for speculation, then the stock market's okay. But I don't think it's an ideal place to really make a plan with, because you know, you're basically putting all of your hard-earned money out of your control when you invest in the stock market. And I learned that by kind of buying into the passive index fund in a retirement account kind of way of going about things. It didn't work out for me because, you know, when I wanted my money, it wasn't there. And I basically was mixing saving, investing, and speculating all into one. The way I like to look at it is the stock market is very speculative, even when you're doing passive index funds. And so there are other places that you can invest in better. Investment that you can actually rely on is probably either real estate in one form or another. There's a bunch of different types of ways to invest in real estate, and also your own business. If you happen to have a business, oftentimes, just because of the amount of control you have, it can be a lot less speculative than investing in the stock market. It's more of an investment. You can invest in your own education. You can invest in relationships with other people and actually affect your money. Whereas in the stock market, there's nothing you can do to increase the value of money you put there. And there's nothing, you know, most people know how to do that can prevent the loss of the money that they put there. So yeah, business and real estate. I mean, the main three kind of asset classes that people like to talk about are paper assets, like stock market, for example, business, and then savings. There's also savings. And I think that people underestimate the importance of having some cash. So I think that savings should be done in a place where you can access the money, not necessarily in real estate because it's somewhat illiquid, and not necessarily in a retirement plan in the stock market because of all the rules around early withdrawal penalties. And just because the money, when you actually need money, it might not be there because of the volatility there. So savings, investments, and speculation. And I think people can do all three of them, should do all three of them, and just kind of know what's what and not think that they're saving for retirement when they're actually speculating for retirement. You know?
I love the idea of investing in these forms like real estate and with your business where you can really affect the value of your money. You know, with real estate, you can upgrade your house, or, you know, you have so many different options to affect the value.
So many options. Oh, for sure. Because in real estate, there's kind of a business aspect to the investment. So there's the asset, which you purchase, but there are also a lot of operations around that that you can do for it to be more profitable, or that you can not do and it could be less profitable. You know, just the people you know, the people you work with, you could rent it out, you know, short-term rentals maybe, and make more than you would renting it out monthly. You could remodel it and sell it. By your own work, you've added some value there. You know, you can't remodel a stock once you've bought it, you know. So I think one distinction also is cash flow. Producing income for yourself is what really leads to the ability to retire, or the ability to kind of not need a job to pay your bills, or not need. And that's one reason I really like real estate. And business can be the same way. When you're investing in your own business too, you can invest in ways that increase your cash flow. It's not just purely a hopes that the asset value will go up. So in real estate, yeah, it has that element. If you buy a property, you hope that the value will go up. But if you have that income attached to it, like a renter, for example, paying you rent, then you don't necessarily need the value of the property to go up, but you're still able to retire because you have an income. Even in the stock market, eventually you're going to need to convert all that money that's built up there into some kind of income so that you can retire. So in business and in real estate, the income is more, you know, it's more a part of it. And there are things you can do to increase the income of a business or increase the income of a piece of real estate. And so you don't need to rely solely on appreciation for it to be a successful plan. Because really, income is what allows you to pay your bills without doing things you don't like to do.
Right. I think for a lot of people, the advantage of investing in the stock market is that you can buy, now you can buy like fractions of whole stocks. So you can start investing when you don't have very much money at all to invest. Whereas real estate requires typically a larger initial, you know, startup fund. So how did you get started in real estate investing? Were you able to like save the 20%, or did you do an FHA loan?
Well, actually, my very first real estate investment was a piece of vacant land. And I had saved up money. I had been investing in the stock market, actually. And when it came time to buy that land, I found that, you know, the crash had happened, and I actually had less money than when I started. And so that was kind of when I realized that the stock market's not a savings vehicle. So many people think that they're saving for retirement, But, you know, the stock market may go up over time when you really average it out. But what about that 5-year time span where you're planning to retire? You know, do you want something, or where you're planning to buy a piece of land or something like that? Do you want to have to wait an extra 10 or 15 years, you know, for the, right. for the market to go back to where it was? You know, so anyway, yeah, I don't want to just bash the stock market, but I just wanted to bring that up because that's, for me personally, I wanted to buy something, you know, I wanted to buy that land, and I had way less money than I had actually saved. My first investment property was, I actually got a little bit creative with the purchase of that one. I had been traveling for a couple years at that point, and I didn't have any proof of income. I had a good credit score, but that wouldn't have mattered to a bank because I didn't have any income. So what I did is, like I said, my friend who's a real estate agent had started talking to me about real estate and, you know, what someone could accomplish with real estate investing. And but I did like a 2-week binge on YouTube at that point, just learning everything I could, staying up all night and getting really, really a lot of information about real estate investing. And I narrowed it down and I said, okay, I want a multi-unit building. I want it, you know, and I figured out all this stuff that I wanted. And I realized that I would need to do owner financing because I wouldn't be able to get bank financing. Mm-hmm. And my real estate agent friend actually had a filter. He could just click a box and all the properties would pop up where the owner would, they were willing to entertain the idea of owner financing. And so we found a property, the owner could do owner financing, but I didn't have any money because I'd been traveling for a couple of years at that point, and I had been spending down my savings. And so then there was that problem. So I didn't have income, and I had kind of solved that problem with the owner financing. I also didn't have any money, but I did have a retirement plan, not a 401k. It was something that I was in the Ironworkers Union at that point. It was like an annuity that they had been funding. And I found that because I had been off of work for over 6 months, there was like a break in service. There was some technical stuff that they would allow me to take those funds out. And I paid the taxes and I paid the 10% penalty. And I was very happy to get that money back in my own control into some real estate. That was enough for my down payment. And luckily because it was owner financing, we were able to negotiate for a 12% down payment on that property. And that was pretty much the entire account that I liquidated and was able to make that down payment. And a few years later, once I had a job again, I refinanced that because my agreement with the owner was that I would need to refinance in within 5 years. Wow. After I had some job history again, I refinanced that property. The property's own income was also able to become my income. After 2 years of any certain type of income on your taxes, then that's considered to be one of the types of income that you earn, and you can use that for getting bank financing. So by the time I refinanced that property a couple of years later, the income from that property itself added to my own job income, and I was able to refinance it pretty easily.
Nice. That's very, very creative. And I think a lot of people are really intimidated by the idea of trying to invest in real estate without having a lot of money saved up. And I was just listening to a podcast episode from the Financial Independence podcast. They're interviewing somebody who invests just primarily with these owner financed deals and works with them to sort out, you know, what they need. And you mm-hmm. know, if they just want a check every month, if that's going to be the most beneficial thing to them, or if they do need a larger down payment to cover their expenses. And, you know, he's been able to do so many deals where he's not even putting any money down initially. I think people just don't even consider that to be an option when they're looking at investing in real estate.
Yeah, that is, it's definitely an option. It just all depends on the seller. I know that not all cities allow an agent to click that one box that shows them all of the owner finance properties all on one page. But a lot of them do though. And yeah. even if your agent can't just check a box, there's conversations that you can have with the seller, because people are always in different situations. Yeah, sometimes they don't need all the money at once, and they're happy to get a big chunk of a down payment, maybe to pay off a HELOC that they have on the property, or just cover the agent commissions or whatever they need to do. with that down payment, and then just get a stream of income from you after that. They can be the bank. It does work. Yeah, there's a lot of conversations that you can have with people and just see what they need and make it work that way. That was basically how it worked for my first property.
So do you primarily invest in real estate where you're, you know, buying and then holding and renting?
Yeah, that's all I've ever done. I've never flipped a property. I do construction work as a W-2 job. I did have a triplex that I bought that needed one of the units renovated. And for me, that wasn't a pleasant experience working on a property that I had bought and trying to, you know, coordinate with people to come and get it rent ready and doing a lot of some of the work myself too. I've just never really been like attracted to the idea of flipping a property, because the ideal things I would do with my time wouldn't be turning over a property. At this point, I might, if I had the right people to work with, I might want to do it in the future. Mm-hmm. But if I was going to be involved myself, it just doesn't seem like something that would be real fun. Another thing is, just through all my studies, you know, before I had ever invested in real estate, I was learning about all the different ways to invest in real estate. And one of the things that turned me off from flipping, and this might be right or wrong, like I said, I don't have experience with flipping, but someone said, you know, with buy and hold real estate, you've basically created passive income. You're an investor. And with the flipping, you've basically created a job for yourself. And I just thought to myself, well, if I'm going to create a job, it's going to be something else, like fist pump finance, for example. It's not going to be, yeah, flipping properties. And another thing is that oftentimes it's short-term capital gains taxes when you flip a property. So it's basically like income taxes. So there can be a lot of taxes taken out of your profits when you flip a property like that. I know with the BRRRR strategy, you can flip a property basically, but then instead of selling it, you just refinance it and put a renter in there. That's very interesting to me. More interesting than flipping just as a transactional thing.
No, I definitely agree. So for those people out there who aren't finance nerds, the BRRRR strategy is it buy, refinance, rent, repeat?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Nice. I think that's just super appealing. And you keep kind of mentioning the relationship between, you know, your W-2 job and these other businesses that you're working on. And, you know, why do you feel like you need to keep working your construction W-2 job? I mean, do you really enjoy it, or is it kind of a strategy?
Yeah, the construction has been really nice for a lot of reasons. At certain times in my life, I was frustrated and felt like I needed to be there to pay bills. And at this point, I don't need to be there to pay bills. I don't need to spend any of my paychecks on any of my living expenses. So my paychecks just, basically I've gotten to 100% savings rate, I guess you could put it that way. So the job is, you know, when I get my paycheck, I basically can just use it for investing or for doing things that just seem to like make my life better. Mm-hmm. Like for example, I've been spending money on things that I wouldn't have allowed myself to before. I was so focused on getting out of dependence on a job, and I was using my investing to kind of be that vehicle that would take me to a place where I didn't need my job. And I was resenting my job and feeling like I just wish this needing to have this job would be over. And at the point where I got to the place where I didn't need the job anymore, something shifted. I took about 9 months off, and then a friend of mine called me and said, hey, I'm starting this job, you want to come work? It'll just be you and me, and you know, we can have conversations, and the type of work we're doing, we'll be able to listen to our podcast. He's kind of like me, and we like hanging out together and talking. And I was the guy that he thought of when they told him they needed someone else on that job site. So it was basically just a decision. Like, I thought to myself, yeah, I mean, I can go back, hang out with my friend, make paychecks while I'm doing it. And it's really not like, I don't have the same relationship with my work recently, you know, just because I feel like I'm there by choice, you know, I'm just there right. So that I can make my life better. And a big thing with W-2 employment is that it's great for getting mortgages. And most of my investing involves mortgages. In fact, I've been starting to see that recently. I've gotten to a point with my real estate investing where most of the stuff that I'm doing is banking. A lot of it is refinancing. It's a lot of paperwork now. You know, like there's the property, but I'm less oriented towards properties now, and it's more about property managers. The lease and the mortgage are like what I see as the assets here in my real estate investing at this point. The lease is in a contract with someone, you know, where I'm going to be paid, you know, on a regular basis. And the mortgage is something where if you do your banking in a smart way, you know, you reduce your expenses. So it's really kind of interesting. It's like there's, you can have a job and then your living expenses. And I almost have that same thing, but now it's not me with a job making a paycheck and then trying to reduce my living expenses. Now it's like this property, and this property makes an income, and I try to reduce the expenses through banking and mortgages and stuff. Having a W-2 job is just so much easier to get mortgages, to refinance properties. And refinancing is very, very cool recently, because let's just say you wanted to save up a down payment, buy a rental property, and have, you know, a certain amount of income come into your life. Sometimes with the recent low interest rates, you can just refinance a property, and with a little bit of paper shuffling, you've got that same amount of extra money coming into your life now in savings, interest savings, essentially. And you didn't need to save up any money or buy a new property or, you know, go through all the inspection process. You basically just increased your income by reducing your expenses. And recently also through refinances, the most recent property I bought was not actually money that I saved at all. It was money that I extracted from another one of my investment properties. So now my properties are buying me properties. Wow. And this is all, it's just banking. It's paperwork, the business side of real estate. Mm. So having a W-2 job really makes that go smoother, the banking part of it. People love to lend money to people with a job.
Yeah. Do you have to have a full-time W-2 job? Or do you think even just having a part-time W-2 job would kind of fulfill the same needs?
Well, it depends. I think it depends how much you make at your job, because they're basically looking at your ability to pay is kind of like what bankers call it. There's a few criteria they look at, your credit score, you know, but also your ability to pay is a big deal. So it just depends how small is your loan and how big is your income. It really doesn't matter how many hours you work. They just want to see your tax returns and your W-2. And make sure that the income you're making is enough to support that type of loan. They don't care about the hours, just how much you make and how steady your employment is. So if your hours were, if it was part-time because maybe you were employed full-time and maybe, you know, it's something's looking sketchy where, I don't know, there's a problem with your profession or something like that, they might question that type of thing. But if it's a steady job at 20 hours a week, in my opinion, that should be fine for a banker. They just want consistency and the consistent ability to pay. But I should say in my own personal experience, with the types of jobs that I take in the construction field, it's union job, it's commercial construction most of the time. And it's just kind of a given that it's going to be 40-hour weeks. And I've never really tried to talk to an employer and say, hey, can I just work 2 or 3 days a week? It might be something that I could do, but I've never tried to do that. So I always work full time when I'm working. Mm-hmm. The cool thing is in construction is when you're done with a building, oftentimes you're kind of like, okay, you know, I've fulfilled my commitment to this employer, and being a union member also, it's really easy to say, hey, I'm going to take time off after this job, or even before the job is over, I'm going to be taking time off in a couple months, and really you have a job waiting for you when you come back. But I like the construction industry also because it's not just the W-2 job helps with the banking. From the very beginning, I liked that profession because being a union member, you know, there's always the union hall trying to put employers and workers together, and you can pretty much stop and start when you feel like it. And I've been able to do a lot of world traveling.
So from your experience, you're working, you know, full time when you are And you're still a union member when you do take time off. So that probably looks consistent to a bank in the mortgage loan situation.
Exactly. Yeah. It looks okay. I oftentimes find myself having to write explanation letters to the bank or to the underwriters who are underwriting the mortgage. And I just explain, this is the construction industry. It's common practice that when we finish a job, we're laid off due to lack of work and we expect to find more work soon after. This is common in our industry. And also I have to explain multiple W-2s sometimes because I might work for one company. When that job's over, I might be working for a different company. Mm-hmm. So these explanation letters when I'm applying for mortgages is really all they need to see. They just need to have a story behind what they're seeing there. There was a gap in employment.
Sure. Are you primarily investing in the Seattle area?
No, I'm not. I own my house where I live in Seattle, but the house I'm living in doesn't really fit my investment criteria. I mean, maybe you've heard of the 1% rule, where ideally you can kind of rule properties out if they don't make a certain percentage of their price every month in the rents. So for example, the 1% rule is like a rule of thumb people use where if they're buying a rental property, a house for $100,000, then they would want the rent to be $1,000 a month. If you buy a property for $200,000, you'd want the rental income to be $2,000 a month. And it's just a rule of thumb to make sure that after you pay taxes, insurance, property managers, the occasional repairs, cover vacancies, and all the other expenses, and the mortgage interest, after all the other expenses, chances are you'll have a little bit of money left over, which can be just like a monthly income for yourself if you can get properties that are approaching that 1% rule. Mm-hmm. And that's never going to happen in Seattle. It would be very hard to find a property that would be that cheap. So in other words, rent, it's a lot cheaper to rent in the Seattle area than it is to buy in the Seattle area. And the way you can tell that is that if you bought a house and then rented it out to people at market rent, that would never cover your expenses.
Mm-hmm. It's an expensive market.
Yeah. It's a very expensive market. And so, I don't buy my investment properties here. I have two multi-unit properties in New Mexico, an 8-unit apartment. That was the first one I bought with the owner financing. And later I bought a triplex there. I planned on house hacking. We moved there into one of the units and renovated another one of the units and got those the two other units ready to rent. And my wife didn't want to be living in Santa Fe. She felt lonely and didn't really like the weather so much. It was too cold. So it didn't end up being a house hack. So now I'm renting out all three of those units. Nice. And recently I've bought three houses in Memphis.
Okay. Interesting. South seems like a really good area to be investing in right now. I know Chattanooga is like a gorgeous city in Tennessee, and I've been seeing houses there for, $50,000.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Also, I agree with your wife about living in Santa Fe. And for the listeners who don't know what house hacking is, it's when you buy a house and then you live in one of the rooms in it and rent the other two out. And that basically theoretically covers the cost of your mortgage payment and you're able to live very, very inexpensively.
Yeah. Yeah. So I buy now I've been buying things in the South. My oldest two properties were those properties in New Mexico. As I learned more about what type of thing I was looking for. Yeah, I am looking for the type of place you might find in Tennessee. Like the $50,000 property that you mentioned would likely rent for $500 or more per month. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of things that I've been looking for recently. And at first, I thought it was a great idea to buy multi-units properties. And recently, I've been buying single-family homes. I would recommend, if someone's thinking of getting into real estate, I would recommend starting out with a multi-unit, actually. I don't know if anyone else would say this, but I can see the value in buying a duplex or triplex, fourplex right off the bat, just because if something goes wrong with a tenant, you've still got two or three other tenants paying the rent, hopefully. So you're not putting yourself in as much risk. to have one problem with one tenant and have all these expenses that you're needing to come out of pocket from wherever else you earn money, you know, money that could have been for your own living expenses. And now you're basically, you bought an investment property, but it's actually costing you money now. It's not supporting itself. So I think that it's actually safer to start off with a multi-unit property. Another benefit of doing that is, in my experience, multi-unit tenants are less likely to be like a perfect tenant. You know, the type of tenant that can't afford to live in their own house just by themselves because it would be a little out of their price range. I think most normal families would prefer to just live in a house, but sometimes for economic reasons, they're required to live in a duplex, triplex, or fourplex. And I've had a lot of problems, but I see them as like just challenges and a learning experience. So I actually learned a lot about dealing with tenants, the potential problems that could come up with tenants. And still to this day, I've kept my first 8-unit building that I bought, but I have more problems from tenants in that property than I do in the single family homes or in the triplex. I think that if you just have one investment property and you start to have these problems with tenants, maybe not paying on time sometimes, maybe not paying at all sometimes, maybe causing damage to the property, and that's your only tenant, it could really make
just sour you to the whole experience.
It definitely could, yeah. And it's just not as safe financially either. So I actually recommend that people try, if they can, to get a multi-unit property if they're thinking of investing in real estate, and experience some of the things that come up in a situation where you're not putting everything on one single person paying you on time and being a good tenant.
Sure. I can also see the advantage of it, hypothetically, just from the mindset of investing in a multi-unit property. You're not going to feel, maybe it's a feminine kind of a thing, but I would imagine feeling really attached to like a home that I bought and wanting it to be, you know, cared for by the tenant in a certain way, and maybe not even like looking at it as much as an investment as if it were an apartment complex, you know, or a multifamily unit where it's not something that I can like customize as easily. And it just would feel right off the bat more like a business.
Yeah, I can see that. I did have a friend who tried his hand at real estate investing, and he likes to be really hands-on, but that caused him to be flying back and forth, fixing things on the house himself. And being attached to the property, I think, made it a little bit harder to have it be, you know, not in the same city as him, and caused some stress that wasn't maybe necessary. Mm-hmm. Been able to easily delegate that to a property manager or other people and kind of be a little bit emotionally detached from the property. I'm not saying to let it, you know, let it become dilapidated. I like to do repairs very quickly and have tenants be happy about the place that they're living in. I feel like I'm not very emotionally attached to the properties, and I think that helps with my stress levels, because there are problems that come up.
Yeah. So you advocate for using a property management company?
Oh, yeah, I do. I think that you can save a little bit of money by doing things yourself. But again, like I was saying before, I'm not trying to necessarily create a job for myself. I'm just trying to be an investor. Mm-hmm. And so I just see that as a cost of doing business. And they're professionals. And oftentimes I pay 8 to 10% of the rent. And I feel like it's well worth it. They're the ones who are dealing with tenants and collecting rent, handling, communicating with people who need to go fix things at the properties. I really do give thanks for my property managers. You know, I basically just look over the books.
Nice.
Yeah.
So when you're analyzing, you know, properties, if you're wanting to invest in a new property, what are the main things that you're looking for?
The 1% rule, that's kind of, for me, that's kind of just a rule of thumb. I don't require a full 1%. And now with property prices going up, it's a little harder to find, but it's a good thing to aim for, to have the rent, the monthly gross rent, be about 1% or more, or as close to 1% as you can of the purchase price. Another thing is kind of my own 1% rule that I just kind of made for myself, because that 1% rule has to do with gross rent and the purchase price of the property. But my 1% rule that I kind of add in there is I would like the cash on cash return to be about 1%. every month as well. So what that means is if it costs me $25,000 to pay the down payment and the closing costs and everything else that I need to pay for the appraisal and inspections, all the money that's coming out of my pocket, let's just say it's going to cost me $25,000, then I would like to see $250 a month net coming out of that property at least. So that's 1% of the money that I actually spent. That basically works out to a 12% return annually, because it's 1% a month for 12 months every year. And that's a great starting place. Later on, you might have some appreciation in the property itself. I like to do the 1% rule for the cash flow there based on what I put into. If it looks like after I calculate expenses, it's going to be 1% net profits, I get really excited. That's more for like ruling a property in. This will be a good one. And the other 1% rule is kind of, I use it for ruling properties out. For example, if I saw a property that was only like 0.5%, I probably wouldn't even spend any more time doing research about it. Mm-hmm. I would just save my time and move on to the next one. Yeah, the first 1% rule about the gross numbers is more like, if it doesn't get close, I just dismiss it. So I use that to rule properties out. And then the second one has to do with my actual income. And I use that to kind of rule properties in if it fits my, if it fits what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. A lot of really good advice. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit more just about personal finance.
You know,
from my understanding of what you do with Fist Pump Finance, you're, you know, offering kind of like overview financial advice for people with, whether it's, you know, with their businesses or just their personal finances. You have a lot of really great testimonials on your website of people kind of in different situations that you've helped to analyze their finances. So I just wanted to talk about some sort of like basic finance things. I wanted to start with what you recommend for people with debt to pay it off first or invest. And in the finance world, you have really conflicting opinions strongly on both ends. Like you've got Robert Kiyosaki of Rich Dad Poor Dad, who, you know, obviously has inspired so many people and is like amazing. And that book is the basis of so many people changing their financial lives around. But he pretty much advocates, from what I've seen in his recent interviews, for investing, you know, completely with debt aggressively. And he'll sort of brag about being like $500 million in debt, but making millions of dollars a day and leveraging his debt. And then you have people on the other end of the spectrum, like Dave Ramsey, who are telling people who are seriously sort of addicted to debt to rip up their credit cards, pay for everything in cash, and never go into debt, not even have any credit. So where do you stand on that spectrum?
I think probably right in the middle. I think that Robert Kiyosaki is kind of sounds extreme when you first hear what he's doing, what he's saying. And I think he's trying to shock people into thinking. I kind of agree with him, but there's a lot of stuff he's not saying as well. It depends what type of debt you have. Ideally, if someone was trying to decide whether to invest or pay off debt, if someone's asking that question, my advice would actually be to not do either one and to save that money that you were either going to use to pay off debts and invest and educate yourself a little bit and build up some capital. Because savings is, it's just so overlooked. It's so important to have money saved up. I think a lot of people really get excited about investing and they don't know how to save money so well. And they also don't know how to invest so well. So they just throw their money somewhere that seems good because it's investing and it's exciting. But I think that pausing and so what I try to do with people is say, pause, let's make minimum payments on all your debts for a little while. It's going to maybe cost you an extra little bit in interest cost over the long term, but you may decide that that's a good thing after we learn more. Let's explore different investment options, opportunities. Let's talk about what type of person you are, what's going to be suited for you, what your goals are, and let's just save. So let some money pile up here. And the way I usually figure it out is ideally your investments are going to outpace your debt interest. So if your investments are going to outpace your debt interest, and that's very certain, you can rely on that. You feel confident about your investments. They're not going to be making money 1 year and losing money the next year. Invest if you're sure that the investment is going to outpace your interest cost. The profits on the investments will pay for your interest cost, and then there will be something left over as well. Then I would say invest. And if you have really high interest debt, like consumer debt often is on credit cards, or debt that just takes a large amount of cash flow out of your life on a regular basis, even if the interest rate isn't high, if you're paying a large percent of your earnings towards debts and stuff, then sometimes it can be good to pay that off. It's going to be very hard to make an investment that can certainly outpace the interest on a credit card. So oftentimes credit cards are the first to be paid off. Mm-hmm. But lots of times it really just depends. I like to look at people's finances like kind of big picture and then make that decision. Pause all of the decisions to invest, all of the decisions to pay off debt, and then save some money while you learn about your options and learn why you might want to keep this debt, because it's actually beneficial to have that debt, and why you might want to do this investment or why you might not want to do that investment. So it depends on the person and it depends on their situation. I like to look at two things, and I bring a little bit of corporate finance into personal finance with this, but there's something called cost of capital. That's just the amount of money that you're either spending to service debts, like your interest. You're basically paying these interest costs so that you can keep that money instead of giving it back to the bank to pay off the debt. And then also the hurdle rate, which on the investment side, sometimes you need to know that an investment is going to make over a certain amount of money to make it worth investing in it. We do these calculations on an individual basis with people to find their cost of capital, find their hurdle rate, and decide based on your debts, based on your particular investment options, based on what you know about how to invest, and based on your own personal situation, your hurdle rate, your cost of capital, then what should we do here? So while we're figuring all that stuff out, I tell people, if you're thinking about whether to invest or pay off debt, don't do either one. Just save your money and learn more.
I love that. And you mentioned beneficial debt. What can you define that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, most people's debt is consumer debt. If you listen to Robert Kiyosaki talk, he just has the term good debt and bad debt. And one of the ways he simplifies it is bad debt is debt that you have to pay off, and good debt is debt that someone else is paying off for you, like in the case of a mortgage on a rental property. Mm-hmm. Beneficial debt, for example, is investor debt. It's productive debt. Consumer debt is bad debt. Consumer debt is debt that no one else is going to pay off for you. You've basically borrowed from your future self, and it's your obligation to pay that back. The debts that most people have are that type of debt. So I personally don't have consumer debt. I don't borrow to buy things. If I don't have the money for them, I just don't buy them. And one reason is because I've focused on savings. Again, coming back to the savings, it's so important for people to save money. Sometimes it's worth it to, even if you do have debt that you don't like, keeping that debt and not paying it off is actually beneficial to you if that allows you to get your paycheck and put it in things for yourself rather than giving it to the bank. Even consumer debt can be good and beneficial if it's allowing you to build up a savings account for yourself or some kind of liquid reserves, an emergency fund. But most of the time, beneficial debt has to do with investing, has to do with being productive. You know, consumer debt often means that you're consuming more than you're producing. You're taking more than you're giving. In economic terms, that's kind of the definition of it. If you have consumer debt, you've taken more from society than you've given to society. I know that sounds maybe a little bit harsh, but that's where consumer debt comes from. And I'm talking economically, you know, financially, you've taken more than you've given. Productive debt, like I was saying with investment properties, you give a lot of people jobs, construction people, property management people, bankers, a lot of people, and the tenants have a place to live. And you're basically, by doing this type of investment, you're being of service to many people. And the debt is also backed by an asset, that's an appreciating asset, and an asset that's also an income-producing asset. So when you have an appreciating asset that's also an income-producing asset, lots of times that asset can pay its own debt service. And at the end of the day, you've not had to pay any of the debt yourself. So that's what Robert Kiyosaki would say is good debt. It definitely is important to learn how to save and be comfortable saving. Having some savings will keep you from having to go back into debt and be in the cycle of having to borrow because you weren't prepared for something that comes up. And that can be psychologically kind of, it's frustrating. It's frustrating if you just thought you were getting out of debt and now something comes up and you have to borrow from your credit card again. So I think that people being comfortable with paying the minimum on their debts and saving up and developing the discipline to not have to go shopping with that money or have to spend that money on discretionary spending, but really see that building up savings is very important. I think that sometimes it's worth keeping debts. Once you've built that muscle of being able to have cash and using it for safety and having a little bit of security by having that cash, then sometimes you can pay off one debt all in one fell swoop, you know, instead of making monthly payments that are above and beyond the requirement. A lot of financial freedom has to do with just reducing obligations and increasing options. And so if every time you get a dollar, you're giving it to a bank to pay off a debt, then what happens if you need that dollar and you don't have any savings because you've given all your extra dollars to paying down debt? Sometimes I recommend that people still only make the minimum payments and have this side fund that they're building up, and they build it up and they build it up until they can go ahead and pay that debt off completely. But in the meantime, they have this safety and this liquidity, and they're not going to need to turn to a bank to borrow more if anything comes up in their life. And that can be really a confidence builder if you can get over the fact that you haven't been making extra payments on the debt.
Mm-hmm. So did you say that's like the number one thing people should do to start to gain control of their finances is to just start a savings?
I definitely think so. Yeah. I think learning how to save is important. I think it's really important. And many people just skip that step and want to invest money. It's exciting to invest, you know, if you want to really have financial freedom, you'll need to build that muscle eventually to be able to have money without needing to spend it on consumer goods. You'll also need to have practices that give you options and reduce your obligations. So that's kind of like the way that I put it. Financial freedom is really, it's about reducing obligations and increasing options. You have options, and there are ways to reduce your obligations. For example, a bank and you have already made some kind of agreement that you have a minimum payment. That minimum payment is your obligation. But if you're always putting extra towards paying off that debt, you're basically giving the bank money that you don't need to be giving them. Instead, you could be using that money to increase your options and then study about your investment options and then invest once you've learned some things. I would say many people want to rush to invest before they've even learned how to save.
Well, how do you see fist bump finance growing forward?
I would like to work with other people, build partnerships with people. Also, I would like to build a network of people who are more specialists. I like to just have conversations with people and explore, you know, ways that I can help them. You know, there's a lot of information that I have that can be helpful for people, but sometimes they need a licensed specialist to implement certain things after we talk about it. So I see that as something in the future, having trusted people who I kind of work with, so that when I work with a client, I'm in their corner kind of looking at the big picture of things. But when it comes time for a specialist, there's someone that I've already built a relationship with that I trust that has a similar philosophy about money, which as I'm helping educate people, they might have a similar philosophy too. So it's going to be important to find a specialist who has kind of thinks the same way and understands some of the unconventional things that we're trying to accomplish. Aside from building relationships with more people who I can refer clients to, I would really like to start a podcast or a YouTube channel or some kind of even a newsletter or a blog and produce content in some way. A lot of the things I share with people are things I've implemented, but sometimes I catch myself thinking like, well, this isn't going to work for me, but I know this would be perfect for somebody. I kind of collect those things in order to be able to share. And sometimes when I'm really excited about just having learned something, it could be really good for me to have an outlet to just make some content to share that thing right away while I'm excited about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a terrific idea. especially YouTube, just for, you know, kind of quick videos on different subjects that you're really stoked about in that moment?
I tried my hand at YouTube. I just made one video. It's a video about 9 ways to buy real estate without a job or any income. Yeah, I have a YouTube channel. I think people can just search for my name and probably find that.
Okay, great. I'll put a link to that in the show notes and I'll check out your video. That sounds really interesting. Well, you obviously have a really strong kind of ethical foundation to yourself and the way that you look at the world and your contribution to it and your life and your, you know, use of your time. So I'm curious to know what is the most important thing to you and why do you think that is of value?
That's a hard question. The most important thing in life?
Yeah, to you.
Well, yeah, to me, I really value time freedom, kind of personal freedom. And all this financial stuff is so exciting to me because I really see financial freedom and money as just something that enables people to do what they want with their time, do it with the people they want to, spend as much time as they want doing those things where like they're living the life they want, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when my whole motivation for becoming financially independent was less about money and actually more about time freedom. And I just get so excited about money because I get time freedom when I don't have to spend my time doing things for money. You know, so I think it's very important to have the just amazing opportunity to just choose what you're doing, who you're doing it with, where you're doing it, and how long you're doing it, and just have that kind of agency. Mm-hmm. It's really exciting. Once you know how you can, you know, how you can help people, then having that financial freedom can just help you have the time to do it, or, you know, be able to put the energy towards being a service to people and just doing all the things, whatever they are for every person personally. You know, I just see everything through a financial lens, partially because I'm a nerd about it. And partially just because I value that freedom so much, that freedom, mm-hmm, personal choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Money's a very interesting tool, but it's just a means to the end of having control and freedom in our lives and autonomy and choice.
Totally. Yeah, it really is a tool. It's really a tool. And it's exciting to, you know, to learn how to use tools to get the results you want.
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. So what do you think is the most significant act that we can make individually to contribute to the health of our communities and larger global family?
Again, actually, I think that having a sense of what your gift is and having a way to either make money doing your gift, or if not that, make some passive income somehow so that you can be freed up to spend your time sharing your gift with people. It's a big challenge to learn what our gifts are, what our purpose is. And it can be changing, you know, it can change and it can be unclear. But I think trying to discover what that is, you know, and then putting ourselves in a position where we're actually financially able to offer that offering, where we have the time to spend our days doing that instead of spend our days just working to pay bills.
Yeah. Right. That cycle of working to pay bills is so soul crushing for so many people. And I think our society is at a great loss because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of gifts that go unshared.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is people just not knowing about finances, being really intimidated by it, or also not having the courage to make changes in their lives. You know, there are complex reasons for that, but I think that's great, finding your gift and trying to share it. That's all we really, that's kind of our obligation as a human, right? Why else are we here?
I feel like it is, yeah.
Do you have any advice for entrepreneurs who are starting out that you wish you had been given?
Yeah, something that I can, you know, I get real heady sometimes. I love learning, studying, talking. And I would say taking action is a big lesson, and I'm still learning it. I guess I could just speak to people like me who like to know a lot of information sometimes before taking action, who spend maybe too much time analyzing or studying before they feel safe putting themselves out there. I would say the biggest thing I can say is that I hardly ever regret when I just go for it and take action. There's plenty of learning to be done while you're taking action. So you don't need to wait until you've learned enough. Just do the things that you want to do. Otherwise, you could be putting it off for many years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I'm also the same way, where I can't learn enough about a thing to feel that I know it enough to take action. And the times that I've had the courage to just you can't like even encapsulate everything that you learn in those moments.
Yeah, learning and doing don't have to be mutually exclusive. And me, as someone who loves to learn, sometimes I forget that. And I actually miss all the opportunities to learn while doing stuff, because I'm trying to learn before I do stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of learning, what are your required podcasts, readings, YouTube channels for our listeners to go out there and learn more about finance and all of the other things that you find really interesting?
I can think of a couple different books, just depending on who it's for. There's one of the basic books that I recommend people read on finance, personal finance, which really, it's kind of fun to read. It's written in a certain kind of like storytelling way. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon. And that kind of drives home the point of paying yourself first and having some savings.
Yeah, and good one.
Yeah. I think that there's kind of different stages that people will get to, where different information is going to be more useful at different times. And like you mentioned, Robert Kiyosaki, and the way he comes off, it's not really the perfect thing to hear for certain people at certain times. But if you're ready to change your mindset and expand the way you think, I would recommend his book. Rich Dad Poor Dad is definitely a classic when it comes to financial things. Mm-hmm. But for me, at the time when I read his book, Rich Dad Poor Dad, that was very new for me. And I think it was a good timing. I was a little bit resistant, but not so resistant that I couldn't hear it and give it the time to try to understand. It is a lot of mindset shifting ideas there. And kind of along those same lines, there's a book, Killing Sacred Cows, by Garrett Gunderson, that I like a lot. Garrett Gunderson's a guy who talks about finance and talks about things in a kind of a different way than many people are used to hearing as well. And he's very business oriented, I would say, not as much real estate oriented, just money principles, things that can apply to personal finance as well. Yeah, Garrett Gunderson is now kind of an influencer online. That book is a good introduction to a lot of the ideas. And for business owners, I think your last guest, Joachim Brunson, might have mentioned this book. I think business owners could benefit from reading Profit First.
He did talk about that book quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a book that kind of takes, it's interesting because in a lot of contexts, I like to introduce people to almost like corporate finance ideas and how they can apply them to their personal life. And I feel like Profit First is almost the opposite. It's kind of taking some basic personal finance style ideas and applying it to business also in a beneficial way, in ways that maybe get overlooked in many people's business. So yeah, I think it's ideal to just set your business up with that framework that he describes right off the bat. The sooner the better, never too early to read that book, even if you're just considering business.
Yeah, fantastic.
Another one is for people who are interested in beginner like real estate information. There's a podcast called Get Rich Education. Keith Weinhold kind of breaks down a lot of things pretty simply and also talks about them in ways you may not have heard people talking about it before. And finally, there's something called the infinite banking concept, which is a little bit controversial, but I personally practice that. It's basically using life insurance to store your liquid capital instead of banks, and even using the life insurance companies for loans at certain times instead of banks. And there's a book by Nelson Nash called Becoming Your Own Banker. If someone has gotten to the point where they have savings, you know, they can appreciate the value of having liquid capital and not needing to have every dollar invested at every moment. I would say, even though it sounds very strange, life insurance could be one of the better places to keep that liquid capital before you invest it. And you know, it's controversial because many people have been taught to be very wary and skeptical about life insurance, and for good reason. There are a lot of products that aren't really made with the people's best interest in mind. But that's a nice book to read, you know, because banks don't offer much of an interest rate, and using life insurance, you can get far better interest rates on your liquid cash, but also you can also get a death benefit as well, and some tax advantages and a handful of other benefits. So Becoming Your Own Banker, that's a really interesting book.
I'm definitely going to have to check that one out as well. Well, thank you. And what song is your jam right now?
This might sound weird, but I'm a musician, and lately the only music I've really been listening to is field recordings that I recorded in my different travels to Africa. I'm kind of like studying my notes, I guess you could say.
Do you have any music recorded online that we could send people to?
I don't have any music online recorded online, but West African percussion music from Mali is what I've been studying for a while, and a good genre to just, like, you know, check out Malian music if you're interested in a new type of music.
Do you have any specific bands that you can recommend?
In that genre of music, I like some of the artists from the 60s and 70s. There was a era where there's a lot of strings and like one female vocalist and maybe a balafone, which is kind of like a xylophone instrument. And that's really, really beautiful music. It's called Bajuru is the name of the genre. Mm. Maybe one person who you could just type in on YouTube maybe mm-hmm. would be Fanta Damba, F-A-N-T-A is her first name. D-A-M-B-A.
Okay, definitely going to check that out. And what is an ethically based business idea or initiative that you probably won't do yourself, but that you would love to see someone else start?
Kind of a hard question for me. You know, I'm not sure.
That's I'm a perfectly really fine sure. answer. What about, what is one of your most favorite plants?
I don't spend a lot of time gardening, but I do really appreciate a few plants in a few contexts. I really like to eat fresh fruit. I love peaches. I would like to have an orchard at some point in my life. That's kind of an aspiration, is to have a fruit orchard, very, very small, not for commercial purposes, just to be able to pick various types of fruits for myself. Also, another one that really is kind of important to me is a nostalgic kind of thing. You know, I grew up in New Mexico. I really love the way that the sage smells when it rains in New Mexico or when there's a hailstorm and it gets the sagebrush just moist enough to smell really good. And that kind of reminds me of my childhood. So yeah, nice. Sage.
And sage smells so good. I agree. A fresh, juicy peach. There's probably not much else that's better than that.
Yeah, for sure. Peaches are amazing.
Well, how can people get in touch with you, Aaron?
I have a page that people can go to that kind of directs them to other pages, depending on what they're interested in. My name is Aaron with two A's, and it's just a short, easy to remember domain name. So people can go to aadavid.com. There's a contact form there. People can schedule, you know, if they just want to talk to me. I like having conversations with people. I really do appreciate it. If anyone wants to reach out and talk about anything or ask any questions, they can go on there and just schedule a time where we can talk on the phone. They can be directed to my financial website. And also I have a website about the West African drumming that I've been studying. It's all linked to on that page there, aadavid.com.
All right, perfect. Thank you so, so much for taking the time out of your day to have this conversation with me.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it. And please, if anyone hears this and feels like just having a conversation about finance or any of the other stuff I was talking about, just reach out to me.
If you want, I can go back and edit that out of this episode at some point. You start getting too
okay. No, I'm not worried about people reaching out to me. I want them to. I hope that they do.
Well, thanks for sharing all your recommendations. I know I learned a lot and really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, have a great evening.
Okay, you too.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, guys. Thank you all so much for listening. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I will put links in the show notes to everything that Aaron and I discussed and all of the ways you can reach out to him. If you want to connect with me, you can email me through growingforwardpodcast@gmail.com or you can connect with me on Instagram @Bethany_growingforward. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your day, and thank you for taking the time to listen. Bye.
Summer, save me. All the structures of my time are insecure with false foundations, and I look for truth and find the views obscure. Without borders in our minds, could we make peace with our own kind? Your fire feeding mine. Like boom ba, boom ba, bra boom ba, brum ba.